Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 17th of December. Ryan Lizza's article in the current issue of The New Yorker is particularly timely with yesterday's ruling by a federal district judge that the National Security Agency, the program that keeps records of all American phone calls, violates the Constitution. Judge Richard Leon of Federal District Court for the District of Columbia used the term almost Orwellian, and the judge ordered the government to stop collecting data on the personal calls of the two plaintiffs. He allowed the government time to appeal the decision, which they probably will. Ryan is with us this hour to talk about his lengthy article, which gives us the history of the intelligence agency, and it highlights several people who are important to trying to either have a full investigation of how much investigation is going on, how much spying is going on, and those who say that it has to happen because of national security concerns and a desire to stop terrorist threats. Ryan is the New Yorker's Washington correspondent. He covers the White House, Congress, and national politics. He's also written for the New York Times, Washington Monthly, and The Atlantic. He's an on-air contributor for CNN. And he won a prestigious prize in 2013. The White House Correspondents Association presented him with the Aldo Beckman Memorial Award for Journalistic Excellence for his coverage of Obama's presidency and his reelection campaign. Some of you, I'm sure, have read the article or you'll have thoughts about yesterday's ruling concerning the National Security Agency's programs keeping track of all of our phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Ryan, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, the article came out the perfect week, didn't it, with yesterday's federal judge decision. Do you want to respond to that decision and tell us whether or not you think it will be appealed?
Well, it will certainly be appealed. I think there's a good chance that this means that the Supreme Court at some point will take up this issue again. It's a really important decision because it's the first time that a federal judge says, wait a second, the logic and legal justification that everyone has been using to justify this law since 2006, or this program, excuse me, the NSA's mass collection of phone records. He argued that the constitutional basis for it that everyone has been using is simply wrong. And so this all, it gets a little technical, but this all goes back to 1979. There's a guy named Michael Lee Smith, and he robbed a woman, and afterwards he started making harassing phone calls to her. The cops went to the phone company, and they put a little device on his phone that captured the phone numbers he was calling, and they learned that he was indeed calling this woman that he had robbed. And they went and got a search warrant, searched his place, found some evidence that he was the robber, and they prosecuted him. In court, he said, wait a second, you didn't get a warrant to get the phone calls that I was using to call this woman, so you need to throw that out. Well, this case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court in 1979 said, no, the government doesn't need a warrant to collect the phone numbers that we dial. It's not protected by the Fourth Amendment. So that 1979 case is what the Bush administration used in 2006 to go before the secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and say, because of this 1979 case, we are allowed to collect not the phone records of one Baltimore robber, but we're going to collect the phone records of every American, and we're going to put them together in a giant database, and when we need to search it in a terrorism case, we're going to be allowed to search it.
Remarkable.
And the FISA court said yes, and every court, and it's repeatedly said yes, and the Obama administration, after the Snowden leaks came out, used the same justification to say that the program is legal. So for the first time, a federal court judge has said, wait a second, the facts in that 1979 case are so different than what the NSA is actually doing, that it's not even reasonable to use that case.
And I was watching the news last night. I can't remember what state it's in, but they have so many records now that they have to build these huge box-like structures, one after another, after another, after another, to store all this information. They won't have room for all these records after a while, will they?
Well, yeah, I think it's public knowledge that the NSA is building this massive data center in Utah because of the volume of data they collect, and not just on this in this program, but programs that are focused on foreign intelligence as well. The volume is just so massive that their appetite for data for storage is insatiable.
I was amazed reading your article how few people, and maybe there are more, you just didn't have time to list them, or maybe it's a growing movement, but how few people seem to be very deeply concerned about the privacy issues here. We're looking at Senator Wyden, we're looking at Edward Snowden, we're looking at Russ Feingold, and we're looking at used to be President Obama, who doesn't seem to be as concerned about this anymore. Is it just a tiny portion of people who are influential who have concerns about this?
I think so, and I think on these national security matters and on these matters of giving the NSA or other intelligence agencies the authorization to run these programs, most members of Congress don't really pay attention to this issue, and to the extent that they do, they defer to the expertise of the intelligence agencies, and frankly, most of them don't want to be the person to deny the intelligence community a program that the intelligence community says could protect us from a terrorist attack. And you only see a few people who really get engaged on these issues. I think the politics have changed a little bit since January 2011, when you had some more, both on the left and the right, some more civil libertarian-minded members come to Congress, like Rand Paul of Kentucky, the Republican,
right,
and a real civil libertarian. And Mark Udall, Democrat from Colorado. Colorado is a very libertarian state. So you've seen a sort of increase in the number of, actually both in the House and the Senate and on the far left and far right, you've seen a bigger coalition that cares about this issue. But it's frankly not something that helps these guys get elected. And then in the Senate, half these guys want to run for president anyway. And nobody's ever really, a lot of them don't see any percentage in reaching the White House by taking away a tool that the national security establishment says it needs. So, frankly, I think it takes a lot of courage for a member of Congress to put, you know, in weighing the security versus liberty arguments, to put liberty first.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about Senator Ron Wyden, who figures prominently in the first part of the article. He gets 15 minutes a year to ask questions of top intelligence officials, even though he's on the Senate Intelligence Committee. 15 minutes isn't very much. He has to use that time pretty wisely, doesn't he? And he spends weeks, you write, figuring out what question to ask.
Yeah, I was surprised by this. And that 15, he estimates in open hearings, that is, you know, hearings that the public can actually watch, he thinks, you know, he estimates that this, before the Snowden leaks, he had about 15 minutes to ask these guys questions. And so he really thinks about what to ask. And what he tries to do is look for gaps between what the intelligence community is telling him in classified briefings and what they're saying publicly. And this led to a very famous example in March of this year, before the Snowden leaks, when he asked the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, if the NSA or the intelligence community was collecting information on millions of Americans, and Clapper said no. Now, of course, Wyden knew that that wasn't the truth. And then the whole world knew in June when the Snowden leaks came out that that wasn't the truth. And that's led to some people asking that Clapper be looked at and be prosecuted for perjury. Other people have called for his resignation over it. But that's the kind of, indelicate question that Wyden has been known for. And frankly, most of the members of the Senate Intelligence Committee don't do that. Most of them are much more concerned with making sure that the intelligence community has all the tools that they say they need, and frankly are not focused on the civil liberties part of the job.
Case in point, Senator Dianne Feinstein, and Wyden and Feinstein, you're right, used to be pretty good friends, but this issue has so divided them that maybe they're not as friendly as they used to be. If you were to ask her, what are the benefits, and other people, what are the benefits of this massive domestic surveillance program, would anybody have a clear answer?
Well, what they say is, you really got to press them to get to the nut of this. What they say is that the NSA has to have all the records from all the different phone companies and assemble it in their own proprietary database, so that they can very quickly search it, So that, you know, if one person's on Verizon Wireless and another one's on AT&T, they've got the records from both of those phone companies, and they've sort of combined them in this database. So if a Verizon Wireless phone is calling an AT&T phone, they have that record. Whereas if they just went to AT&T, it wouldn't be able to. AT&T wouldn't be able to tell them that information, or at least not with the same speed. So, you know, that's the first thing. They say they need to collect everything and put it in their own database to make the information useful. And then, of course, the second thing is they say that they need all of this because they want to discover connections between foreign terrorist suspects and domestic people who are in the United States now. Now, and Wyden and others have really pressed them and asked, what is it that you have discovered through this program that you couldn't have gotten through traditional search warrants? You know, what attacks have you broken up, or what investigation, what leads have you found? We're really not getting a whole lot of examples of attacks that were thwarted or people who have been prosecuted through this because of this program. And I think Wyden is on pretty solid ground when he argues that you could give the NSA the same capability, or the FBI the same capability, but just have them do it through traditional search warrants.
What about the president in all of this? He had promised, you write, that if he became president, his attorney general would immediately conduct a comprehensive review of all of our surveillance programs, and he had indicated that he had problems with some aspects of these surveillance programs. What happened? Did he see something, that some phone call that was intercepted, one of the millions caught his attention, and it saved somebody from doing a terrorist act, and thus he completely changed his mind? What happened to that review?
Well, it's a really good question. One I looked at closely, and I think it's hard to figure out. I mean, some people argue that he, as a non-expert on some of these intelligence matters, and as someone who really, before he was president, didn't know anything about these surveillance programs because they were all secret, and he wasn't on the intelligence committee, when he was briefed on them, at a meeting in early February 2009, just days after he was sworn in as president. He deferred to the experts in the intelligence community, and who told him that these programs were essential and that they were legal. And because they were legal, he was okay with them. I think one of the critiques of this, of Obama signing off on these programs, is he's sort of asking the wrong question, not whether it is narrowly legal, not you shouldn't let the intelligence community do anything that they can get the secret FISA court to sign off on. You should be asking, is it right? Is it consistent with his view of the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution? I think the other part of it is he was dealing with a lot of crises in 2009, both in foreign policy and in domestically with the economy. And on foreign policy, he was fighting the Pentagon over troop levels in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was trying, although he failed, to shut down Guantanamo Bay, and he was fighting with the CIA because he made good on his promise to end torture. And some people have argued that, you know, shutting down, reforming these surveillance programs, which he was being told were legal, wasn't high on the list of priorities given all the other fights he was having. And I think the final thing is just the obvious thing. When you become president and you realize that you are responsible for the safety of the country, that when the intelligence community tells you it needs to collect everyone's phone records to keep us safe, a new president might not be so willing to deny them that capability. I think at the end of 2009, he'd already made this decision in early 2009. At the end of 2009, on Christmas Day, we almost had an attack in this country. An underwear bomber almost took down a plane landing in Detroit. And I know a lot of intelligence officials said to me that after that near-miss attack, whatever doubts Obama had about these programs or about his commitment to things like the Patriot Act, which he'd always been a skeptic of, it changed.
Mm-hmm. So essentially he was worried about a perception of a presidency. If you can't thwart another terrorist attack, what good are you?
Well, exactly, and it made it very real. Now others would say, well, you have to look at the program, you have to look at these things, the specifics of the programs, and you have to ask the question of whether this specific program really would have done anything to thwart that attack. And I know in the case of the underwear bomber, there's no evidence this specific phone records program would have done anything. But look, you were right to point out that as a candidate, he was a severe critic, especially when he was running for the Senate in 2003 and 2004 of the Patriot Act, which is used to justify this phone records program. And he was a severe critic of the specific language in the Patriot Act that justifies this program. I don't know if you remember it, but in 2004 he gave a speech at the Democratic Convention. Probably the most famous line in that speech was when he said, we worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states.
Yes.
That reference to libraries, that was a reference to the what's known as the library records provision, and that's the very provision that is used by the NSA to justify this program. So he was a critic of it going back quite a ways.
I want to find out about the history of the FISA courts, what exactly, when they were established and what kind of authority they have, and who knows anything about what they're actually doing. Ryan talked about intelligence experts. A lot of people say, well, you know, I'm not an intelligence expert, and so I can't really comment on this. Well, who are this, even this massive surveillance program, who are the intelligence experts in this country? Who knows exactly what's going on, and who decides what it is they're going to be doing? We're welcoming phone calls for Ryan. Ryan Lizza is our guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. We'll put the article on our Facebook page. It's in this week's issue, the December 16 issue of the magazine, State of Deception, Why Won't the President Rein in the Intelligence Community? And our conversation, of course, particularly timely today because of the ruling yesterday by the federal judge saying that there were constitutional issues here and that we were looking at a program of Orwellian proportions. Would you agree? You can't talk about all of this without discussing Edward Snowden and his revelations about the NSA. We've heard that there are many, many more to come. Did he change the equation here and make more people concerned about this massive surveillance? Are you concerned about this? I'm amazed that not too many people seem to be expressing a lot of concern, and some are saying it's because we already give out so much information that if you're on the internet, people know what ads to give you because they've already combed all this information. But does it upset you as an American citizen? Do you see this as Orwellian in proportion? We certainly would like to hear from you, and here's how we can hear from you. Call us at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. Ryan is The New Yorker's Washington correspondent covering the White House, Congress, and national politics. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Our lines are filled, so if you're trying to get through, you can try our email, which is talk@wpr.org. And we start our calls with Rick in Harshaw. Hi, Rick.
Hello, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Well, I appreciate you bringing this topic to the air, and it's something that's been on my mind for quite a long time. And I'd just like to speak to or echo your comment that we seem to have just sort of easily accepted this generalized surveillance, whether it's by corporate interests of our commercial activities or whether it is by the United States government. And it strikes me as strange that we should just accept this as, I had a guy tell me the other day, well, it's over. Privacy is, you know, is gone. You just have to accept that. And mm-hmm. I don't accept that. And I appreciate people like Russ Feingold, who voted against the Patriot Act, the lone vote in the Senate against the Patriot Act. And we can only look back to Justice Brandeis not that long ago, a century ago, who actually had civil liberties concerns about taking photographs of people in public. In other words, if you were in public, that anyone had the right to come up and just photograph you, and how far we've come from that. And it's just simply a comment, and I'll take the whatever comment you have about that off the air.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for the comment. Ryan?
Yeah, I think that's a great, great point. And, you know, Fourth Amendment law, if you look at the history of privacy law and what is an illegitimate search by the government, the standard that the court set out a while ago, and look, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a legal expert, but I've looked at this in the course of reporting. The standard is basically what society decides it is, and that's why the ruling yesterday is so interesting. You know, in 1979, the court ruled that, well, nobody really had the expectation of privacy over the numbers they dialed, because they knew that those numbers went to a third party, the phone company, and therefore they had no expectation that the phone company might not share it with the police. Well, what the court argued yesterday, which I think is a really important point, is in 2013, our expectations about what is private and what is not has really changed. And the telephone itself is such an important part of our lives, and the way we communicate is so fundamentally different than 1979 that we really need to look again at what privacy means in the digital age, and the courts need to sort of update this view. And if they don't, at the very least, Congress and the president should, and they shouldn't just passively accept this narrow Supreme Court opinion and use it to justify something that the court never in a million years could have contemplated.
How instrumental has Snowden been in bringing this all of these issues to the forefront, and how has he changed the conversation, if at all?
He's been absolutely essential. We would not be having this discussion right now absent Snowden. We wouldn't. I talked before about how James Clapper went before the Senate and did not tell the truth about what the NSA is doing. Ron Wyden, in my piece, said that absent Edward Snowden, Clapper never would have corrected that statement. In fact, Wyden tried to get Clapper to correct the statement, and he refused to do it, and he only did it after the Snowden revelations came out. We wouldn't even, I think it's fairly unlikely that we would know anything about the program we're talking about today. Remember, before June, early June, when this was the source of some of the first revelations, we still had no idea that the NSA was collecting all of our phone records on an ongoing basis and searching them when they wanted. So there's just no doubt about his central role in this debate. Whatever you think of him, and you know, I understand people have complicated opinions about him, but the bottom line is this debate wouldn't have happened without him, and that opinion yesterday in this D.C. Circuit Court wouldn't have happened without him.
Steve in Wausau, hi.
Hi. My question is, maybe we don't have a lot of dissent about this because people are afraid to say anything. When I look at the dystopian novels I've ever read, all of them, they always start off pretty much with the government getting to know what everybody's doing, what everybody's thinking. And then that leads always to all these terrible, terrible problems. And I'm just thinking that maybe we should just put a stop to this right now. And the security that we're gaining just isn't worth losing our liberty pretty much absolutely. Pretty much as of now, you know, so that's my thought on the matter.
All right, Steve. Thanks. Ryan.
Yeah, I think if you can justify a program, even a program that collects all of our phone records, which is, you know, what I think is fairly described as a mass surveillance program, although I know that the NSA refuses to call it that. And people like Senator Dianne Feinstein, as she said to me, it's not a surveillance program. It's a data collection program. Now, even if you accept their terminology here, I think that Americans are willing to give up quite a lot if you can prove beyond a doubt that you're getting something in return. And the thing here is they just have not proven that this program is important to keep us safe. I mean, that's what's so jarring is the amount of privacy being violated, the amount of data that's being collected versus what they're actually getting out of the program is just so mismatched.
Well, you would think, wouldn't you, Ryan, that mistakes could be made too, and they could overlook a phone number or they get the wrong phone, the wrong record. We're talking so much data. I wonder how it can be completely flawless.
Well, I have to be honest. When I first went into writing this piece, I was agnostic on this question of whether this program was worth it or not. I think I was probably leaning more towards what's the big deal? It's just phone records. I think what really turned me and made me think, my God, that we should not be letting the government do this, is the history of compliance issues that the program has had. And this has all been declassified not just because of Snowden, but because the government itself has put out some of these opinions. And if you look at the secret FISA court in these declassified opinions, if you look at from 2006 to 2011, the way that the court consistently smacked around the NSA and said, you guys are not running these programs consistent with our rules. You are violating the rules. You are searching for things you're not supposed to be searching. And at one point, the court even says on the phone records program that it has never been run according to the rules. And that history of violations and, frankly, inaccurate statements that the NSA repeatedly made to the FISA court, and let's be honest, they never had any reason to believe any of this would be public because the FISA court operates in secret. So they figured, well, nobody's going to know about this anyway. Whatever we can get past the FISA court, let's just push it as far as we can. That whole record, when I reviewed that, it just gave me no confidence that the NSA should be allowed to continue this program. And if, you know, now's the time to have that debate. And if there's not some brakes put on what the NSA does now at this moment, given what we know, there never will be. We're sort of at one of those pivot points in the history of surveillance in this country. And if this debate sort of just peters out with no change, then if you're one of those officials at the NSA, I think you would safely assume that you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. And when you say putting the brakes on the program, it's kind of a complicated program. Are you talking about the phone records?
I'm talking about the phone records, and that's the one that's really at the center of the debate in Congress. They say that they have stopped collecting Internet metadata, so that one is really not up for debate anymore. Allegedly, they've stopped doing that. You know, the other program that is very controversial is the collection of email and phone calls and the way that they collect email and phone calls. I think they do have a decent case under that program. This is the one that is known as PRISM. I think they have a decent case in that they're collecting some communications of terrorists that is leading to them breaking up plots. Now, that program has some problems. It's collecting a lot of information, 250 million discrete communications a year.
Goodness.
Yeah, and because of the way they collect it, they're sweeping up, they say incidentally, a lot of purely domestic communications. And now, so there are a lot of smart people who have looked at that and said, well, you've got to tighten that program up so that they're not collecting, for instance, an email that I send to you because we're talking about some terrorist suspect incidentally. That's really the two programs, is metadata and content. But the one that I think is the source of the most concern and the one that is really the center of the debate in Washington is the phone records program. And I think you have a simple choice here. You either tell the NSA that they can no longer collect these phone records, or you tell them they can just keep doing it business as usual. And you're going to see a lot of proposals out of Washington that might look like they're reining the NSA in. But at the end of the day, that's the important question. Are you allowing the government to keep collecting this stuff or not?
Mm-hmm. And who tells them that? Whose decision is that? Congressional decision?
That's going to be Congress's decision. So right now you have two pieces of legislation that are competing. One by Dianne Feinstein, which says this program is fine, it protects us, and I'm going to write it into law, I'm going to codify it so there's no ambiguity about its legality. That's one way to reform this, is just to codify it. The other way is what Wyden and Patrick Leahy from Vermont and Rand Paul from Kentucky and a few other folks, and they're saying, no, we need to end the program. The NSA can no longer collect all of our phone records. If they want to search our phone records, they can go to the court, get a warrant, and then they can do it. But the legal principle here has to be probable cause. You have to be suspected of a crime before you can go and collect data about someone.
Right.
You can't collect the data first.
Email, interesting one from Stephen Madison. Consider, please, Ryan, in any modern nation, East Germany, Russia, China, the covert security state branch of government always takes on a life, mind, and permanence of its own. Beyond the scrutiny of any elected officials who simply come and go every few years, surveillance state personnel and justifications remain always growing in power beneath the surface flutter and controversies of any administration. J. Edgar Hoover, a perfect homegrown model of this phenomenon. Any way to address the persistent covert growth of this covert government apparatus?
I couldn't agree more. And if you look at the budget of the NSA from 9/11 to today, it's expanded exponentially. And these programs expanded. And they operated in secret. And the FISA court that oversees them is largely deferential. I mean, you read these FISA opinions, and it'll go on for several pages criticizing the NSA for not following the rules. And then the last page will say, but I'm just a judge. I have to defer to the executive branch about what keeps us safe, so you can keep the program running. That's sort of the typical FISA opinion you see. And, you know, in fairness to the court, they don't have the expertise or the authority to do a whole lot more. And then if you look at Congress, the intelligence committees, I'm afraid that the sad history of the intelligence committees in the last 20 years is that they become co-opted by the intelligence community. And for understandable reasons, they're much more concerned with making sure that the intelligence community is doing everything they can to prevent an attack. And there are not that many members on the intelligence committees that are doing aggressive oversight to make sure that there aren't any privacy violations going on.
John in Janesville, our next caller. Yeah, John, hello?
John, not that many members of
John, you got to turn that radio down. We'll come back to you. Yeah, I thought everybody remembered that. Yeah, let's go to Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. I do have my radio off. So.
All right, thank you, sir.
I guess the concern I had immediately when I heard all, you know, this huge amount of data that was coming in is there a way, really, a secure way of drawing from that data and coming to conclusions? Because it looks like what's happened with both the CIA and the NSA is that they have so many mega millions of data, information, that if something gets reported to them, they can't find it in all the clutter. You know, the shoe bomber, his father went to the embassy in Nigeria and said, my son is a threat. I want you to watch him.
Hmm.
Nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
Bombers in Boston, they were moving back and forth to their home country, and no one even knew it. So I'm sure that this data is somewhere, but I really wonder if they can really draw from it or if they're just in like kind of like picking blackberries. They just want to get more and more of them.
You know, it's a really good point, and you do hear that from a lot of people who are in the intelligence community, that just collecting everything isn't enough, and they have increasingly more and more sophisticated mining software that that doesn't just collect things but helps them find what's actually important. On this program, on the phone records program, their argument is that they need to collect the entire haystack of phone calls. If they want to be able to go in later and search for the needle. That's sort of the premise of this one. I think one other point that might help listeners in understanding, because I know the volume of leaks from Snowden has come so fast that I find it myself really confusing. But one way to think about these programs is, you know, the NSA does lots and lots of foreign intelligence gathering, and the laws that govern that are pretty expansive. The NSA is allowed to go out into the world and pretty much collect anything they want. That's sort of what leads to something like, you know, tapping Angela Merkel's cell phone in Germany. They're really unrestrained when it comes to foreign intelligence gathering. Domestic intelligence, which I think is the issue that Americans need to be the most concerned about, it falls under different authorities, and it's overseen by this FISA court, and that's really the issue, domestic surveillance, that is the source of more controversy and of debate in Washington, where there's actually some legislation to change it.
Thanks, Ralph, so much for your call. We'll take more in just one moment. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Ryan Lizza is our guest this hour. He has a piece in the current issue of The New Yorker. As you're looking for background information concerning the NSA and the decision that a federal judge made yesterday that this massive collection of phone information from millions of Americans is unconstitutional, is Orwellian in its proportion. It will, of course, be appealed, we think, I assume, eventually perhaps getting to the Supreme Court. Ryan gives us background on surveillance programs. He goes back quite a few years and looks at who's looking at the intelligence community now. What kind of oversight do we have? What are they collecting? What is the purpose of this? Has it served any really good purpose to mine millions and millions of pieces of data on American citizens. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Ryan is the New Yorker's Washington correspondent, covers the White House, Congress, and national politics. Hour two of our program, Doris Kearns Goodwin will join us to talk about her latest book, and it's really a fascinating time in American history, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about Pope Francis, who becomes more and more interesting with each passing day, Time Man of the Year. Father Jim Martin will be joining us. Among other things that he does, he is the chaplain for the Colbert Report, so he will be with us tomorrow to talk about the new Pope. Daniel in Madison, hi.
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 Very interesting program. Reminds me of when I taught about the Fourth Amendment and particular void in the Constitution of the word privacy, and even the court at times, even back to Griswold versus Connecticut, that dealt with contraception, that was there even an issue of privacy? And I think the same issue came up when the arguments were being made about abortion. And maybe it's something we need to amend the Constitution to specifically put the word privacy in there and what it does mean, because I think what with the power going toward the federal government, no matter what party is in power, part of the thing is the slippage of American people paying attention to what's going on. And then you get into all sorts of things being kept secret, like, say, even the drone warfare. And I think most American people would be really shocked about how that has come about and how powerful it is and might create future problems for us in the name of privacy, secrecy, and not privacy, but the whole thing. But it'd be interesting in your guest's comment about the word of privacy not being in the Constitution. I think it's implied, certainly, in the Fourth Amendment.
Thank you, Daniel, for your call. Ryan?
Yeah, it's not there, although we've got this pretty rich history of Supreme Court opinions that are sort of a guide towards when privacy is being violated. And you know, the Fourth Amendment is very clear about protecting us against unreasonable searches. And the question here about this phone records program is and one that this judge answered in a new way yesterday, is it an unreasonable search for the NSA to collect all of our phone records? And just so listeners are clear about what that means, a phone record is essentially what appears on your billing record each month. So it's the numbers that you called. It would also be the numbers that called you, the duration of those calls, and the time and date of those calls. But then also some more personal information. If you're using a cell phone, it would be the unique identification code of your cell phone. And it would also be some technical data, what they call trunk lines and things like that. Those are the lines that the calls actually go through. And if you know enough, if you have all that information, you can actually get some pretty detailed location information about people, although the NSA swears that they're not looking at that. Anyway, is that an unreasonable search? Is it an unreasonable search for the NSA to collect all of that without our permission? And the FISA court, this secret court, since 2006, has said no. And this judge yesterday said they're wrong, that given modern technology and the privacy concerns with amassing that amount of data and searching it, that indeed it is an unreasonable search and is therefore unconstitutional.
Here's another point of view, Melissa from Madison. I am not concerned about NSA monitoring. I don't expect them to be able to completely explain how the intelligence will be used or has been used, because by sharing too many details, they may sabotage their efforts. If there is even a chance that some brilliant statistical mind working in government may use the data to save even one life, it will be worth it.
Well, I think that's a not uncommon opinion, and other people think, well, I don't care. So what if they have everyone's phone records? As long as there are, you know, presumably there are some safeguards, and if that can help them prevent a terrorist attack, even though if it hasn't in the past, then so what? And I don't, you know, I think that is an opinion that has to be has to be seriously dealt with. You can't just be dismissive. And I think there are plenty of Americans, if you look at the polls, who have that same opinion.
Considering, Ryan, how much surveillance is going on, we must be spending a massive amount of money on these buildings and on personnel, on the technology. A couple questions here. Who is making the decision what all it is we're going to be doing, how many buildings we need, how much money we're going to spend on all of this? Where is that oversight?
Well, it's a good question, and it's the Intelligence Committee that where it starts. And both the House and the Senate, they're the ones that approve the budgets for the intelligence agencies. Now, as you probably know, those numbers are classified. They're secret. We don't know exactly the breakdown in who gets what, we didn't know until Snowden released what was previously known as the black budget. And what we learned after that was that the NSA gets more money than any other intelligence agency. It's absolutely massive.
We go to Charlie in Milwaukee next. Hello.
Hi. Great topic. My question, and I've been thinking about this since this all started, is you're really using a third party to communicate by phone, i.e. the server or the telephone company or whatever. And how can someone expect privacy when they use a third party or something else to deliver the message? Thank you.
That is a great question, and that's really the basis of this privacy law. That's the basis of this what's known as third party doctrine. If you've given your information to some third party, you no longer have the right to privacy, and that's the idea that this judge yesterday has really started to challenge. And, you know, I think that, to me at least, it goes a little too far to think that just because if I want to make a phone call, I have to have a relationship with a third party, just because of that necessity that the privacy over my information that's related to that third party is sort of blown to bits. If you extend that analogy, well, what about the information you give to a bank? What about the information you give to an internet provider in terms of the websites you visit and who you email? And I think that it might have made sense in 1979 when they put this, you know, mechanical device on a rotary phone. But in today's communication world, boy, to me at least, it looks like that policy needs to be looked at again.
Yeah. Marty in Milwaukee, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. First, a note of praise for your guest work. I am thrilled that somebody is following this so closely. Two quick points, if I can. One is a mystery. I'm puzzled by the lack of response from the political party or the political alliance that would decry large government, because this seems to me to be the most egregious exercise of large government we can imagine, to have the government listening in on everything. The other point is the corrosion, the absolute subversion of confidence in the government when we hear statements guaranteeing privacy, only to learn, because someone's had to leave the country, been exiled, that was a lie. And at what point then are you able to believe anything you hear as being, you know, they say they're not reading the mail. Well, can we believe that if they didn't tell us the truth on the last three items?
Mm-hmm.
I'll just listen to you about your thoughts. I can listen to your thoughts.
Thank you.
Off the air.
All right. Thanks, Marty.
Two really good points.
Mm-hmm.
One, I think that this is a fissure within the Republican Party, and much more at the base and the grassroots. You do actually see the people who are anti-government are not just anti-government when it comes to health care or spending on the poor, but are also deeply suspicious about these programs, and you have a much more libertarian strain in the Republican Party at the grassroots. I think your caller is right. It hasn't necessarily translated to the leadership in Congress, although the House of Representatives has a lot of Republicans now who are really worked up about this program, more so than the Senate. On the other point, I'm forgetting his second point. Well, let's just take the next question. I forgot what.
Yeah, and there are fissures. I wanted to ask a follow up about fissures in the Democratic Party as well, as your article shows, with Wyden and Feinstein leading.
Well, yeah,
off.
There you go. You have two leading Democrats on the Intelligence Committee who are completely at odds over this issue. And if you look at the history of the votes on things like the Patriot Act and other surveillance activities, it really does, the two parties really are divided on this.
Yeah.
And I think it'll be interesting as we go forward into the 2016 primaries, both Republicans and Democrats, you're going to have two wings on this issue. And I think it could, you know, it could really be something that that divides both parties.
Mm-hmm. Paul writes, it's not only domestic data collection that is a concern to U.S. citizens, or should be. Rampant overreaching foreign collection destroys foreign goodwill toward the U.S., not only of governments, but particularly of the larger foreign public. It also sets a terrible precedent, an example. If the U.S. is doing this, why shouldn't we?
Yeah, and I apologize. I didn't mean to be dismissive of the important issues about what we collect overseas. And I think he absolutely nailed it. And the question you need to ask when you're doing any kind of collection overseas is, what is the value of the intelligence worth the risk of the fallout if it's exposed? And clearly, what went on with the German chancellor. This has created a very serious
yes.
rupture in our relationship with Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if people were asking that question, they wouldn't have authorized the collection.
Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I want to talk about the slippery slope aspect. Two callers back said she's fine with the government, you know, looking at her phone records. Well, then, to save one life, how do we deal with the government that can, you know, use license plate readers to find out where every car is at every second? Why don't we just open our homes once a month to let this Gestapo-like government come on in and look through our books that we're reading to see if we're reading anything controversial, and maybe check on our weapons to make sure everything is safe? I mean, I'm not ready to live in a country like that, and I don't think these soldiers fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan are fighting for our government to do what it's doing to us. They're actually fighting for the exact opposite. They should be fighting for freedom and for the people in Iraq and Afghanistan. If their governments, as soon as we leave there, start spying and then using that information to torture their enemies, their political enemies, how long is it before that is actually happening in the United States and political enemies can use this inside track to attack each other?
Ryan.
I think the slippery slope argument is more appropriate when it comes to government surveillance and privacy than in most issues of the law. Just look at how a case in 1979 that authorized a device to be put on a low-level robber's phone for a few days, how that eventually turned into the justification for the NSA to collect all of our phone records. I mean, this is the history of privacy rights in many countries. There's not one sweeping usurpation of all of our rights, but it's a slow and steady change over the years. And moments like this, when these things are revealed, are the moments to put the brakes on things.
Kenneth from Janesville says that surveillance has prevented 52 9/11s. I don't know where he gets that information. Have you heard anybody say that?
That's one of those numbers that just continues to live on the Internet, despite the fact that it's been repeatedly debunked. It's not true. It is a number that the intelligence community originally put out, and they said that the phone program had helped in 52 cases. As folks have looked further into that and asked more questions, we're now down to two cases where the intelligence community can credibly say that this program helped. But I would say even in those two cases, we're not talking about terrorist attacks being disrupted.
So what happens with Judge Leon's decision yesterday? Will it be appealed, Ryan?
It will definitely be appealed. He said as much. He basically said he knows how controversial this is, and he knows it will be appealed, and that's why he actually stayed his order. He had an order in there that told the NSA to stop collecting the information on the two plaintiffs in the case, and he stayed that order pending the appeal, because I think he knows the case he's making is controversial, because he's basically saying this Supreme Court opinion that everyone's relied on since 1979, it doesn't control in this case. And he's the first judge to say that, and I think he realizes that's not everyone's going to agree with him. So there's another case in New York that the ACLU has brought and by the end of the year, we'll have some more information about that case. And, you know, it'll be similar to the recent decisions on health care reform. We may get one jurisdiction that says this program's fine, another jurisdiction that says, no, it's unconstitutional. And that's usually the path by which something of this importance gets before the Supreme Court.
Well, thank you for covering this story, which is of such importance. Thanks, Ryan.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Ryan Lizza, his article is in the current issue of The New Yorker. We'll post it on our Facebook page. It is an important one, and it looks at the whole history of surveillance and what's happened post 9/11. Thanks to KP Whaley and Lisa Nalbandian for helping with this show.